What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Grey Malkin Lane podcast, where queer friends and allies gather to review and discuss the original X-Men comics in continuity order, except once in a while when I take you into a fever dream involving elephants and the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We're going to go to a very weird place. The theme on the show in March 2026 is parody and gimmick, and we're going to be giving you, for our issue review, some of the most gimmicky X-Men nerdiness you have never heard of, opening today with Power Pachyderms. And we're a little extra queer today. My friends Rex Ogle and Andrew Wheeler are joining me on the show for the first time ever. Incredible queer writers. I'm such a fan of you both, and it's such an honor to meet you. So let me have you introduce yourselves to our guests, tell us your pronouns, a little about you. And my initial question for you both as we're starting is, where were you in 1988, and what were you obsessed with? Power Pachyderms comes out in 1988. That's why we're going to start here. Let me first welcome Andrew Wheeler to the show. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, thanks for having me. Him or any pronouns is fine. 1988, I was 12, so I think I was obsessed with X-Men comics when I was 12. Like, that's what you do when you're 12 years old. I think, I'm trying to think what was happening around that time. Was that Australia? Like, yeah, I was obsessed with Mark Silvestri art, with Rick Leonardi art, with how hunky all of the boys they drew were. So that was 12-year-old me trying to work out why I was feeling things for Colossus and Havoc. I know now.
In that order, Colossus and then Havoc?
Yeah, actually. I mean, Nightcrawler would be up there too, but he wasn't in the book at the time, so, you know.
Let me also welcome the incredible Rex Ogle to the show. Hi, Rex.
Ah, incredible. I was hoping for uncanny.
Well, there's plenty of show ahead.
1988, I was... Oh, this is embarrassing. I was not yet an X-Men fan. It wasn't until the next year when I was 11 and in sixth grade that my friend William introduced me to X-Men. Before that, I had just read Batman and Superman. I thought Superman was boring. Batman was cool, but it really irritated me that he never killed anybody. And so I was just kind of like, comics are okay, but they're for kids. It wasn't until I read X-Men in sixth grade that I was like, oh, now you're talking my language. This is my jam. And Havoc. Havoc was my first crush. Jim Lee. Jim Lee, what an artist.
I think, Rex, you and I have similar stories. I've read a little bit of your background. You've released a memoir, etc. Andrew, I don't know as much of your personal story. I found the X-Men because there was a ton of trauma happening in my house, and I needed a world to escape into. I've talked about this on the show before, but in 88, I hadn't yet found the X-Men. I was a huge Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles head at the time, and it was kind of with the advent of the cartoon, or just before that, when I started finding X-Men, because I was picking up the TMNT book by Archie Comics every month, and they canceled it, as well as their companion book, The Mutanimals. So we're going to talk about TMNT and Mutanimals a little bit today, which is why I'm bringing this up. But X-Men became my first love after that. X-Force was my first book, and Cannonball was easily my husband all the way through high school. So,
ooh, X-Force, you suck. I am New Mutants all day long. Love New Mutants. And then as soon as Rob Liefeld jumped on New Mutants 87, it was downhill from there. They got rid of Danny Moonstar. Ilyana had been gone for a while. I mean, there was just, Cable? Boo.
But he gave us Shatterstar, so, you know, I have a lot of time for Shatterstar.
Shatterstar can get it as well. We're going to be talking lots of swords and early 90s, late 80s kind of adventure-y stuff. Power Pachyderms is a little X-Force-y, if I'm honest. Now, Andrew, what was your origin to the X-Men? Where did you join the franchise?
Yeah, I grew up in the UK. We didn't have easy availability of comics back then. There weren't any comic shops in my town or anywhere near my town, in Hastings, which is on the southeast coast. Yeah, I was reading whatever comics I could find at garage sales, at boot sales, is what we call them in the UK. And so we didn't have regular access to comics, but I would find a reprint of a Spider-Man annual from the 70s, or I would find that occasionally there would be, like, once every Christmas, there would be a hardcover collection of Marvel comic stories, completely out of context with everything else that was happening. All you knew was one issue. It was Captain America versus the Tumbler, a character who I think has never appeared again since. It was Hulk having fever dreams in the desert of all the other gamma-radiated characters. And it was Psylocke versus Sabretooth post-Mutant Massacre. That was the first story, X-Men story, that I can strongly remember reading. There were probably some others that I'd read in black and white and hadn't attached to as much because they'd have been the early, slightly dorkier stories. But Psylocke versus Sabretooth is a whole awakening. I mean, that's just such an iconic tale. You know, to see a female hero kicking ass and surviving against this absolute massacre-oriented villain. That was what hooked me in.
Rex, for you. I'm trying to remember. I mean, here's the thing. I think it was Uncanny X-Men 276. It was Wolverine and Gambit fighting on the cover. It was Jim Lee art. It was so beautiful. And it was, basically half the X-Men were fighting the Shadow King on Muir Island and the other half were out in outer space. And that's when I jumped on and I was just, Jim Lee's art was insane. Christopher Claremont's writing was beautiful. It was just, a perfect match made in heaven for me.
So all three of us are writers. All three of us are huge X-Men nerds. All three of us are queer. There's a lot of connecting points already, which I adore. Rex, we're going to focus on X-Men relationships.
Okay.
Tell me about the relationship between Danielle Moonstar and Ilyana Rasputina.
Come on. Ilyana had just been spit out of hell, limbo. Professor X put her on the team, even though she was best friends with Kitty Pryde, younger sister to Peter. And even though Kitty was her best friend, she was having a really hard time fitting in with the New Mutants until her and Danny went to the future and saw some bad shit happening with the New Mutants and the Hellions. And just the way Danielle accepted Ilyana, despite her background, around the time of the Demon Bear saga, it was a true friendship. It was like Meredith Grey and Christina Yang from Grey's Anatomy.
I love that comparison. Yay.
But when I was a little kid, these were diehard friends who took care of each other, who loved each other, who accepted each other for all of their faults and all of their dark secrets. Ilyana's my favorite character of all time. I find it incredibly irritating that she's so popular now and I haven't had a chance to really write her character. But one day, I already have a 10-year script that I've been working on since I was a kid. And I will fix what they've done wrong with Ilyana Rasputin, and there is much.
We have, in the latest Magic book, there's been a lot of exploration of this friendship specifically. It's a lot about Moonstar and Ilyana's connection. Now, Rex, you got to write, of course, a backup story in All New X-Men Annual Volume 2, number 1 in, I believe, 2016. I'm going to read the opening two panels here where Magic has teleported Danielle Moonstar into LA. Magic says, "I should change my name from Magic to Uber." Danny says, "Beats Magic school bus." Ilyana says, "Bus, is that a crack about my weight?" To which Danny responds, "Bitch, please, I don't shame my friends, not with my diet choices." And this is everything I needed to know that a queer writer put this dialogue together, including Leah. This is something Leah Williams would write, which automatically brings a giant smile to my face.
Wow. I remember the bus joke. I did not remember the weight joke. I'm like, would Ilyana say that now?
Well, and also, "Rich, please." Andrew, tell me about the friendship or the relationship between Emma Frost and Ellie Fiennes.
Yeah, that was a really fun thing to get to dive into, because when I was approached to write the Negasonic Teenage Warhead story, I went through all of her previous appearances. And of course, she doesn't have that many appearances. But one of the key appearances is her first appearance, where she dies and is carried out of the wreckage by a diamond form Emma Frost. And we know that Emma Frost is burdened by tremendous guilt about all the students that she's seen die. You know, she's, for all that she appears cold and indifferent, the one thing that always haunts her is the death of students under her care. She's trying to make them tough enough to survive in the world. And so it's a huge failure, but also an emotional burden. So to have a character like Ellie Feenster, who came back, but also radically reinvented herself and is, it turns out, a very powerful mutant, to have that relationship where she can turn to Emma and say, "I need your help with this thing right now." And Emma will drop things for her and will continue to be her teacher. That was the really fun thing to write, the sort of scenes in Genosha where we're seeing Emma both dealing with their shared trauma and also trying to help Ellie to continue to learn and develop. and move past the throne.
I have a Negasonic Teenage Warhead episode out on my show. You can listen to my dear friend Robin Moffat, who is trans and from Scotland. And I really jump deep into the world of Ellie and how she represents Emma's trauma in a particular way. And we, of course, got to delve into your story with Ellie specifically. So my second question for you, Andrew, how does one craft a story about Negasonic Teenage Warhead? You have this, you had an unlimited comic format and an unlimited amount of space in which to tell the perfect Ellie Fymester story, whose popularity, of course, really skyrocketed after the Deadpool films, where we get a very queer-coded storyline, even though Grant Morrison has clearly written them as queer from the very beginning.
So, I mean, unlimited is a bit of a misnomer. You're quite limited writing an unlimited story. The page counts are quite strict. It just doesn't look that way.
You get the equivalent of six.
Yeah, X number of panels across those six pages. So, I had a lot of things that I wanted to achieve in a very short number of pages, because Ellie's powers are incredibly scattered from one appearance to another. She seems to have a completely different power set. And the other big thing that I wanted to do, besides tidying that up a little, was to give her a relationship. She's been very cold and cut off from people. Like, she didn't like Krakoa, which makes a lot of sense when you consider she is Genosian and mutant island paradises don't vibe well with her experiences. So to give her a Yuki to have a relationship with, who is based on the movie character, but the movie character is based on a different comics character. Again, nothing is simple about Negasonic Teenage Warhead, but those were the two priorities. Make her powers make sense and get her in a relationship with a Yuki so that we can see her, you know, we can see the queerer side of her made plain.
Yeah, and when her powers being what they are, to rewrite reality with kind of limited focus, you kind of introduced the idea that she's pulling in versions of herself from other realities. Yeah. And there's such a beautiful queerness to the way you write this story. This idea of like reinventing ourselves with a slightly different lens, but it's also her fear of queerness and being different that's kind of blocking her powers. Unless she fixes this, it's going to end the world kind of energy to your story. How much of that was intentional related to queerness specifically?
Oh, I mean, does it need to be intentional? If I'm writing it, it's going to happen. that's the reality. But no, I did make choices that I thought were important to reflecting her identity. When she takes on this Galactus form, I thought back to early Galactus comics where he would say, "I hunger." That was his statement of purpose. And so Ellie's statement of purpose is, "Don't look at me." And she is a giant planet-tall creature with incredible cosmic power. And she's saying, "Don't look at me." And everyone else was like, "What the hell? What are we supposed to do?" That felt very queer to me. That felt like the sullen gothic teenage girl inside me reaching
it. It's really well done and quite moving and really resonant.
Thank you. That
particularly with trans readers, I have a lot of trans friends who've read these stories and feel very represented by this character. Really, really beautifully done. I think it's epic.
Thank you. That's so kind.
Staying focused on kind of queer, somber topics for just a moment, Rex, in your all new X-Men annual story, we find Lady Mastermind, the incredible, voluptuous daughter of Jason, really struggling with Mpox and lashing out at the world with their kind of rage. It's giving me AIDS era like queer storytelling in this particular one. Do you want to talk about writing Regan?
I mean, first off, I love that character so much. She is so awesome. There's so much that can be done with her, you know, being the daughter of a supervillain. And I mean, he did horrible, horrible things. I mean, poor Jean Grey back when he was putting her in the Hellfire Club outfit, which I loved. I was like, this is so cool. But yeah, when Mpox started happening, the very first thing that I thought about was HIV and AIDS. You know, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s when that was a very scary thing that was out there. And it was always associated with gay men in particular. So as a young queer kid in Texas, you know, obviously I was not able to like be myself or come out, and I was terrified. I thought that just being gay meant that I would get AIDS and die. And that's, I'm talking like 6 or 7 years old. So yeah, when Mpox started happening, I was like, oh, I have to write this. I basically begged the editors. I pitched them a 6-part miniseries. And they're like, no. I was like, how about 4? They're like, no. And I was like, 3? I was like, how about just one issue? And they're like, we'll give you a short story. And I was like, oh my God, like, how do I take this story that had this very oof? Because I mean, it made so much sense. Like, Danny's powers to find her Valkyrie powers are to find people who are about to die, you know, and Ilyana would be taking her around, and the two of them would have this, you know, series of adventures, you know, trying to save people and watching their friends die. I was told it was too dark. So we ended up with the short story, but, you know, I packed as much emotion and friendship stuff as I could into that. I don't even think it was 10 pages. I think it was 8. It was not enough room.
Okay, my third question for each of you is on the topic of, here's the fucking coolest thing I saw you do in my review of your X-Men work. So Rex, tell us about getting Armor's armor to go snicked. You read an incredible story about Armor dealing with her grief over Wolverine's death. Hellion gets some really silly moments in it, but that snicked part is like, yes!
Yeah, I mean, it was just, when I read the X-Men, like, I have so much love for it, and I know that he's been canceled since, but Joss Whedon's run, Astonishing X-Men, I thought was great when it came out. I loved the character of Armor. I love Ilyana Rasputin.
We give ourselves permission on this show to enjoy the content created by shitty people.
Because for me, one of the things, you know, growing up with trauma as a child, like, that's why I loved Ilyana Rasputin so much. She was a kid who grew up in hell. You know, at a very early age, she was fending for herself. She was all alone. She was watching people die. That was very much my childhood. The fact that Belasco took her soul and, you know, she took it back and made it armor and made it a sword. She found a way to defend herself with it. Like, that's very much in the same parallel as Armor's armor, which is something to protect her from the outside world, but you can't protect yourself from emotional stuff. That's not a physical attack. So yeah, when they were like, do you want to write a Death of Wolverine story? And I was like, absolutely. And Armor just seemed the right one because I had not yet developed an appreciation for Jubilee, which I have only developed in the last few years. I've always hated her, but now I love her.
so many of your words match my experience. It's crazy. Until about 2 years ago, I kind of hated her always, but I'm very fond of her.
I will say, like, her formative years when she was taking care of Wolverine and her, the two of them and Psylocke were running around Madripoor, I was like, oh, she's like a little badass. But they just never took her powers far enough. And I mean, I love Gen X. Generation X was awesome. But again, I wanted to see more. So here's the thing. I don't believe there are any bad characters. I just think there's bad writers. But I will not say who, because that's not nice.
I was reading some Larry Hama Wolverine the other day, and like this icky creature comes out of, you know, wherever and appears before Jubilee, and she goes, oh, barf. And I laughed out loud. And then I'm like, if I love this in Boom Boom, why do I hate it so much at this character? I'm still not sure I have an answer.
Yep. That might be the answer, though, because if you love Boom Boom, Jubilee comes along like this upstart copy, and it's like, okay.
Until you read Leah Williams' Exterminators, which makes all the difference. Yeah. Andrew, you have a delicious moment where you're writing Marvel Boy and Hercules in your Marvel Princess Pride story. This title is ancient and modern, and they're bonding about their relationship, what they have different, what they have in common. And then they turn the corner, and the perfect ancient modern threat has made itself revealed to them as a creature called the Supreme Medusa. It's a Gorgon. With the Supreme Intelligence, just delicious irony. Tell us about writing these two characters in such an odd relationship for me.
I don't want to enrage the Hercules Iceman shippers, but Hercules already has a twink boyfriend. He doesn't need Iceman in his life. And when I was offered the chance to write a Marvel Pride story, that was my pitch, was I want to tell a Hercules Marvel Boy story. It's like, no one else is pitching this. No one else cares as much as I do.
Well, and Al Ewing had beautifully paired them up. I got to interview Al about the Hercules coming out story, which is quite complicated on its own.
Yeah, I had been wishing for Hercules' identity to be confirmed, and also for Marvel Boy's identity actually to be confirmed, because he was always a bit sort of asexual in the other sense, not the queer sense, but in terms of being written, sort of he has other things on his mind, and so to have him confirmed to be queer, to have Hercules confirmed to be queer, to have these very different characters together. It just, I mean, I could have written 100 issues of their couple. No one would buy it for 100 issues, but like the idea of this ancient god and this super sci-fi, hyper-evolved alternate universe punk kid finding a kind of weird, perfect union. I wanted to make sense of their relationship, and that's what that story was about for me.
It's really fun. Loved it. It's wonderful to celebrate your work. I hope to have you both back on another time. We can celebrate more, but we're getting ready to delve into the world of the power pachyderms. We're all of a similar age, which I love. I'm 47, so I grew up in the 80s. My initial love was collecting He-Man toys. And there was a ton of like action figures where they just kind of started going gimmicky marketing. So He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, if you look this up, there's like the core cast of characters. But as the toy line started expanding, there'd be like a bee guy whose name was Buzz Off. And there'd be a skunk guy whose name was Stinkor. And they just were mass producing these toys that were based off of animals. Spider-Man has an entire rogues gallery of animal-themed supervillains. But one of the He-Man toys that I had as a kid was, you can look this up on Google, it was an action figure called Snout Spout. And it was an elephant. He had a little pack on his back that you could put water in, and then you pushed a button on his back and it would squirt the water out the trunk. So it was like an interactive action figure named Snout Spout. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles is coming out around the same time. And this is the whole thing where like ooze is dripping on people or on animals, and then they turn into some adult version of themselves. Look at the Ninja Turtles toy line. It's ridiculous. It goes on and on in a very similar way. And there's also an elephant guy in this world named Dr. L. He looks like a witch doctor. He has a whole origin story, but Dr. E.L. So there's a weird kind of genre of elephant themed characters that are showing up as a subgenre of these animal-themed superheroes that we're seeing. And somehow, I do not know the origins of this fucking book, but Power Pachyderms is what comes up in the middle of all of this. Had either of you ever heard of this book before I proposed it to you?
No. And I pride myself on being quite smart. In the X-Men universe.
This is one of the great works, of course. I thought I had, and then I read it and realized, no, I was thinking of like seven other books that came out around this time that were like weird one-shots, like Suburban Jersey Ninja She-Devils, and like there were a bunch of very weird one-shots that were all satire and often TMNT inspired. But this one was new, it turns out.
And go back to the 80s and look at toy lines. There were all kinds of things that are less popular or known now, like biker mice from Mars and battle toads. And there were all these really odd genres and like variants of these same kinds of themes. Now, the very last panel of this book has the Wolverine character turning toward you and being like, hey, this is just a fucking parody. Get over it, basically. And this is. It's a tongue-in-cheek parody, which Marvel and other companies also have a lot of history with. There's always been kind of a Mad Magazine line. Marvel back at the beginning had things like Not Brand Eck, and later the What The series. Stuff like this is like Fred Hembeck style humor. We recently talked on my show in the trial of Uatu the Watcher about those weird Watcher parodies where it's like him flicking channels on all the weird variants of everything out there. Like, what if Cyclops shot his optic beams out of his ears as a literal like one panel spot? Well, today we get to learn what happens when Cyclops shoots the beams out of his nose. We're going to step into a world where we have parodies of our X-Men characters, and it's crazy, and they're all elephants. Let me ask you both, as we're building into this, what was your least favorite thing about this book?
Oh, there's so many things I didn't like. I think my first gripe, because it's on the cover, is why is Elektra there? Elektra's not an X-Men.
Yes.
No, incorrect. Why not? I mean, there's 1,000 amazing X females to pick from. Why is Elektra there? It doesn't make any sense.
We have a cast of four, and the elephant parodies are off of Colossus, Cyclops, Wolverine, and Elektra, which is an odd choice. Frank Miller was huge in the late 80s, right? We have to acknowledge that.
Yes.
But the Elektra character is also shoehorned into a Jean Grey role.
Again, that doesn't make any sense.
Why not just do Jean Grey?
Okay. So Marvel does have a weird genre of elephant themed characters as well. Can you guys think of any elephant men or characters that look like elephants running around the Marvel universe?
Mammo Max?
Yeah, Mammo Max is the first one you're going to think of. Mammo Max is the member of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. His real name is Maximus Jensen. I totally want to do a Patreon on this guy one day. That's where I do my character focus stuff. He has corrosive stomach acid, and he just looks like a big old super strong elephant.
I don't know if I can think of any others.
So there's a She-Hulk villain called the Man-Elephant. His name is Manfred Haller. He later gets the powers of an elephant god and turns into what they call the Behemoth. There's a weird foe of Wood God named Elephantine. There's a little known member of the Imperial Guard named Mammoth, as well as another Mammoth from the Black Wolf, very obscure series. And in the Ultraverse, which connects to Marvel through the early 90s, there's a character named Mastodon. There's also another mutant character that is an elephant person. This is from the Extreme X-Men. There's a character introduced that has only appeared a few times. His name is Tantra, T-A-N-T-R-A. His real name is Ruben O'Hara. He is an elephant mutant who has the power to make your libido go crazy. And he only appears a few times, and then he uses his powers on M-Day. So there's more than one elephant mutant, everyone.
Okay.
I love the idea of an obscure wood god villain, like there are any well-known wood god villain.
Right, right. Obscure and also wood god villain.
Wood god.
There's also a Thor villain named Tentaro, who's a super strong elephant-themed guy, and one called Mammoth that fights the Hulk. There may be a few more of these, but again, it's kind of a weird subgenre of character when you think of the person combined with the elephant. Many forms and many animals.
What if you could learn more about your health in under an hour? The Pronuvo Whole Body Scan gives you a comprehensive look at your health, screening for over 500 conditions, including many solid tumors as early as stage one. High-quality imaging, no radiation, no contrast. Book your scan today at Pronuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com. Gain clarity, confidence, and peace of mind with Pronuvo. Invest in your health today. Visit Prenuvo.com. That's Prenuvo.com.
So we're going to launch into our series here. We have the Power Pachyderms. Warning, any similarity between this book and the X-Men is probably just a cheap commercial ploy. We have four primary characters, and they all suck.
Well played.
The cover is a parody of X-Men number one from the 1960s, where we have the team swinging in to fight Magneto behind the shield. But this Magneto is not our Magneto. We're just going to save the reveal for a little bit later as we jump in. This book is written by Roger Stern. And the art in this book is by the incredible Maddie Blaustein. And if you don't know who Maddie Blaustein is a transgender icon. Madeline Joan Blaustein, a.k.a. Kendra Bancroft, lived from 1960 to 2008. She was a Jewish, trans, sometimes identified as intersex, actress. She was also a Marvel editor and a Marvel writer, and she penciled one story for Marvel ever. Maybe there was like one other backup story, but she drew the Power Pachyderms specifically. That's her only major artwork at Marvel ever. She came out as trans after her time at Marvel, but she was the editor on Web of Spider-Man, Marvel Tales, Marvel Saga, and she wrote some issues of Conan. Also, if you are a fan of the original Pokemon cartoon, she was the voice actress, one of the voice actresses behind the character Meowth in those old stories. If you've ever watched like Kirby Right Back At You, she did Chef Kawasaki in that. So there's a whole bunch of voice acting that you can find there as well. So celebrating Maddie Blaustein today, look her up. Very well worth knowing our queer history. Please.
Now I know that this was illustrated by Meowth. I like the comic so much more.
Meowth drawing elephants. Yes, exactly what you did. Joe D'Agostino's on inks, Bob Sharon on colors, my friend Janice Chang on letters, Howard Mackey and David Wall are the editors. Rex, do you want to tell us about the cover here, the cover layout?
The layout's good. I mean, I will say, like, giving Colossus the sword kind of threw me off because I was like, oh, Silver Samurai? Also, right. Because Elektra was there, so I was like, oh, there's some ninja action. The Cyclops, I didn't think was Cyclops because while he has the glasses, he is shooting his optic blast out of his nose. And then Wolverine, I didn't get Wolverine at all either because he's got two tusks.
Wolverine does not have adamantium claws. He have tusks. He has tusks that pop out of his face. Long metal blades.
Why not three on each side? Just to be clear. I just feel like this is a lot of missed opportunities. And also, Power Pachyderms? Why isn't the Power Pack here?
Yeah.
This definitely makes me feel like it's an X-Men ripoff.
They are in the cover box. Magneto has a weird helmet that has musical notes for horns. I'm going to make this joke probably just one time this whole issue. There's an allegory between the elephant trunk and penises. So if you look at the cover, there are three very hard trunks and Wolverine's is still quite flaccid. So we'll let ourselves that joke one time before we jump right into the story. Okay, the origin of these characters is just fucking stupid. This whole issue is a mix of pop culture references that you have no reference for unless unless you were living in 1987 or after, or shortly after. And it's like a mix of genres that's just all over the place. It's truly crazy. Once upon a time, a few years ago in the great southwestern desert, there came a train, a circus train to be precise. As it chugged through the night, the last car somehow came loose. Now, you're already noticing some really odd stuff. In the very first panel, the smoke from the train in the third panel is cropping up into the first panel, and there's a snake that's coughing because of the smoke. In the second panel, we have like a Curious George character somehow releasing the train. And in the third panel, you have kind of this like trolley car that's just skipping along on a nearby track. Every panel in this book has little gag images worked into it all the way through the book. Some of them hilarious, some of them silly. In panel four, there's a miniature of like the Eiffel Tower and a sandcastle and some funny signs. Like the gags are just gagging through all of this. I will not point them out one by one, but if you have any favorites as we go, I'd be thrilled to hear that. So the train car comes loose because a monkey released it. And then it stops in a place where they're doing a gamma bomb test. But there's a guy who looks like a supervillain from like an old-timey melodrama with like, he's going to tie like a damsel to a railroad track, who's there to sabotage things. Now, in the original Hulk story, this is a Nazi character. So keep that in mind. We're going to get to Nazis later in this book, weirdly. This guy runs a card trick to distract the military while pushing a button that makes a gamma bomb go off. But in this world, Bruce Banner, instead of becoming the Hulk, resembles roast pork, it says. The sound effect is Foom, which is the old Marvel magazine, Friends of Old Marvel. And we have an elephant car clickety-clacketing through this. There are four apparently female pregnant elephants in this car that get hit by the gamma radiation, and they all later give birth to mutant baby elephants in a truly bizarre series of events. That's the first three pages. There's Thomas the Tank Engine gags. There's Mad Magazine gags. We're not going to go to all the places. But Andrew, let me hear your thoughts on this origin story.
Yeah, it's kind of economical. You know, three pages to establish all four of these characters' origin. It's insane. I was grateful that it only took three pages. The fact that you have this wild German Russian spy with the monocle that hops from one eye to the other. The pregnancy twist. Like I assumed these elephants were the ones getting the powers, but no, they're going to have offspring, irradiated mutant babies, which of course, I guess if they're an X-Men riff, they have
It ties into the early 60s X-Men, weirdly, which all the characters' parents had like been exposed to nuclear radiation somewhere, and that's why
they'd all gone on a picnic to Alamogordo.
And then we get to our big reveal. Here's the tagline. Thus were born these freaks of nature, these elephants of the atom, shunned and rejected by a world they seek to protect. You'd think they'd learn, but no, they are the most preposterous heroes of all. Power pachyderms. And they all have distinct personalities, and they're all terrible. Andrew, tell us about Trunklops. He of the devastating nose beams. Cyclops in this world is Trunklops, which is the worst thing he's ever done.
Yeah, and as Rex points out, he still wears the glasses even though his power comes out of his nose. But he also keeps a ruby quartz gemstone in his trunk to block his beams from going everywhere. He dresses kind of more like Corsair than Cyclops, down to having a sword and having a red-blue costume. And he's blonde, so maybe he's Alex Summers instead? I mean,
he's confusing. He's kind of hot in a weird way, like a cartoon elephant kind of way.
His
you have very strange
torn
taste.
His clothes get torn and hang off his shoulder in a very sort of like, you're supposed to objectify this elephant kind of a way. And I was like, oh, this is curious. This is quite a feeling.
Colossus in this world is a woolly mammoth. So mammoth beneath his steely wool exterior beats the heart of a poet, but not a good poet. But Rex, tell us about mammoth.
His next panel on the next page is very racist. I don't even know how to describe it, except that it says he went to the Orient to find true enlightenment, but the only thing that got him enlightened was his pockets. So yeah, he got robbed. But it's a very racist image. Yeah, he was not my favorite character. He was the least interesting. I much liked Electrolux better. She was living with a Greek family, working in a diner. I mean, that's cool.
So Electrolux, Electra is here. She is the martial arts mistress of mayhem, working in a diner where today's lunch special is peanuts au gratin, cabbage rolls, and French fries. That's her origin. She was a waitress for a Greek family. Do you want to talk about the visuals? She's just kind of a sexy Electra ripoff, and they draw her very curvy and with big old elephant feet. It's weird. It's really weird, you guys.
It is. It's, I don't even know what feelings it elicits. I mean, usually I look at comic book characters and, you know, something is riled up down in my nether regions. This comic book had the opposite effect. There was at no point at any turn did I have any feelings in my pants.
And then finally, the littlest one is Runbo. He's short and he's mean and has retractable razor sharp tusks. When you get right down to it, he's just not a good role model. Andrew, what are your thoughts on Runbo?
I mean, we have enough Wolverine, but what were his powers? Like, he and Electrolux don't seem to have actual powers in spite of being exposed to radiation. He gets his added tusks later, and unfortunately he's our point of view character.
He has nunchucks and razor tusks. She has swords and ninja skills, inherent, yes, abilities perhaps.
Shocking if it's true. I will say the Power Pachydermes intro page that you're reading from, the way Electrolux is drawn in that, I think is just a phenomenal piece of art, the sort of classic Electra style, throwing body and
flanked, you know, by the moon shapes behind her.
Yes. I think that's maybe my favorite illustration in the whole story. Also, I love that she works in a Greek restaurant where they serve cheeseburgers and chips. That's so true to my experience living in Toronto. So I'm assuming it's a universal experience.
So there is casual racism and casual sexism through this book, mm-hmm, which was very of the times, but we're not going to point out every panel. This book is worth a read. It's worth a slow read because there's a ton of gags worked in. But basically, very quickly, when the circus went belly up, these four young elephants had to go find their way in the world. Mammoth went to the Orient and got his pockets picked. Electrolux, I'm going to get their names wrong, worked in a Greek restaurant. Trunklops ended up in an orphanage, quote, like nobody wanted him. And we see this weird image of him in his apparently rebellious years wearing a peace shirt with sunglasses on and a headband, and he's picking his trunk with a finger, which is so gross. It's such a weird image. I hate it so much. And then
he's also wearing a leather cuff on his left wrist.
Yes,
I don't think that outfit is a very strange choice on several levels.
He just got back from a Lila Cheney concert. Wolverine's character, Rumbo, is smoking through a lot of this book, so you also know it's a classic. He ended up in the far north, in the Arctic Circle, where he liked to drink in bars and play darts. But one day he gets in a bar fight. Someone bonks him over the head with a baseball bat, and he wakes up in the middle of the Arctic, having been given metal tusks with a note pinned to one of them that says, "Best wishes, a friend." So this is apparently this world's version of the Weapon X project. And I don't know, it's a weird story, guys, all the way through. And Rumbo's like, you know, basically, I better go find all of the other characters. He has to climb over a big mountain for reasons. He makes his way to the top and he finds Electrolux, who is basically at the North Pole, trying to find herself. Then the two of them come across a group of, in this world, they must be monks, I suppose, but they're parodies of not the Three Stooges, but the Four Stooges, because for the Three Stooges heads out there, there are four of them. Okay, yeah. We're going to pause for a moment. Rex, what are your thoughts so far?
Of all the things I've read lately, this is probably my least favorite. My favorite that I've read in the last month, though, was actually Andrew's book, Black Flamingo, which I thought was amazing because I bought it years ago and then I gave it to someone, so I didn't get a chance to read it. So I just bought a new copy and that was awesome. So yeah.
I love people who buy two copies.
The Three Stooges reference, like, I immediately knew who they were and that was cool. But what threw me was the fourth one. And I'm like trying to figure out, is he Alfalfa from the Little Rascals, but he doesn't have the little hair sticking up? I don't know. I don't quite get it. Again, it's a missed opportunity. The gag would have been good if they just stuck with the three.
So there are four Three Stooges. So there's a guy named Emil Sitka who was the fourth Stooge that's lesser known.
Oh.
But he would often play kind of the straight guy in the ensemble. So you had Shemp and Moe and Larry and so the different characters. And, you know, there were actually six Stooges that worked in and out, but this guy is kind of famously called the fourth Stooge. So it's worth, yeah, if you want to go look up that history. The Three Stooges are three Stooging all the way through this. There's hammers and pies and seltzer sprays and toilet plungers. And at the end, basically, they are breaking the fourth wall like Deadpool. And they're like, we need to send you guys on a mission. Here's your other two friends from the circus. Go find Trunklops and Mammoth here. It's truly, I don't know, it's not that worth it to spend the details of this fight. So
you asked earlier what was your least favorite part, and it was the Four Stooges. For me, it was the part of the book where I'm like, was this exciting in 1988 to throw a Stooges reference at the kids?
Wild choice. Do you know what this whole issue feels like now that I'm thinking about it? It feels like an epic, like longer episode of like Animaniacs. It's just truly like the pop culture references with the cartoony voices. It's truly crazy. That actually helps me like it more when I think of it that way. Okay. So Electrolux and Rumbo, who has a tattoo heart on his arm that says mom, are in a boat called the Unsinkable. They seek out Mammoth, who is fishing, and he triggers into his metal form and looks like the Silver Samurai. Electrolux is like, where did his pants go? And Rumbo says, maybe the same place my tusks do. For reasons, he jumps into the water and comes up with a treasure where there's a whole bunch of gold in it. And I don't know why we needed that at all, because now they're off to find the Cyclops character, Trunklops. And this image of Trunklops and Rumbo is giving that like Scott Summers Wolverine kind of queer vibe that we often get in the comics. Andrew, do you want to talk to us about this interaction? Trunklops has got his ruby quartz gem blocking his trunks.
He seems to be in the depths of depression, standing at the end of his pier. I don't know what he was planning, but it didn't look good. And thank goodness for Rumbo to save the day. I don't understand why he's called Rumbo. Like, I get the Dumbo joke, but why R? Why the letter R?
Rambo. It's Rambo Dumbo.
It's Rambo Dumbo? Oh, God.
That's okay. My guess. Well,
that makes some kind of sense.
He grabs Trunklops by the trunk and is holding his trunk for so long until the Jean Grey character walks in looking all sexy and they're like, oh, look at her. It's
another great bit of Electrolux serving body. And another panel. These are my favorite bits. But yeah, we get Trunklops with his eyes bugging out with hearts instead of pupils. So we're fully in cartoon logic.
Okay, I do want to spend a minute on their headquarters. We jump to the headquarters of the Power Pachyderms in New York Harbor, not far from the Statue of Liberty. They're in the water. The ground floor of this place, by the way, it's called the Peanut Gallery, is a yacht, like a ship, like a pirate ship sitting on the water called the HMS Peanut 4. And it is on top of a Baxter Building style building that is completely submerged underwater with so many pop culture references, I can't possibly give them all. It's one page, but it's truly insane. Floor number one is torpedoes. Floor number two is a swimming pool. Floor number three is their meeting rooms. Floor number four is like their movie theater lounge, which is projecting a pink elephant up on the screen. Floor number five seems to be bedrooms. Floor number six seems to be their training facility, which is where the elephants currently are. Wild concept already, but what do you guys notice in the water around the building? Anything you'd like to point out?
The first thing that I noticed was the Alice in Wonderland witch, sorry, Wizard of Oz witch down in the corner.
Elmira Gulch. Do you remember the scene of the beginning of the Wizard of Oz where the witch is riding her bike where she thinks Toto's in the basket? It's da 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 Burns is writing at the bottom of the ocean for reasons.
But below that is Danger Will Robinson, the robot from Lost in Space.
Forbidden Planet. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then also Vote for Mondale and Ferrara. I actually had to look that up because I was like, who are these people?
Hey, 1984, Walter Mondale is on the Democratic ticket, and his running mate is a woman named Geraldine Ferraro, who's the first female candidate on a public ticket in American history before Kamala Harris or Hillary Clinton. She later served as Clinton's ambassador to the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. The Republican Party did a huge smear campaign on her, and the world hated her during this election, and they badly lost to Ronald Reagan. So there's a lot going on in this
panel. Wow, Republicans smearing a woman, revolutionary.
Yeah, the history doesn't feel that different. We've also got like King Triton from The Little Mermaid over on the right.
And that's who that is.
We've got a weird like Jacques Cousteau fish. There's so much going on here.
And Jaws. Don't forget Jaws.
Jaws, absolutely, on the bottom. I think that's a yellow submarine up on the right. And it looks like the Emerald City behind that, like the image from the Emerald City. Someone queer clearly wrote this. It makes me think of so many queer people at the time who were working in cartoons and just working in pop culture references. Okay.
Also, HMS Peanut 4 is a great pun.
Oh, absolutely. This is ridiculous. And I kind of love it. The more I'm talking about it, the more I like it, actually. It's so camp, it's terrible. Andrew, do you want to talk to us about their training sequence?
Yeah, they're fighting the dancing brooms from Fantasia that they have to quickly so they don't get sued. What was going through Roger Stern's when he decided that was the natural opponent of a team of elephants? We get a fastball special with some real strong foreshortening happening on Rumbo with tusks out. And of course, he's thrown straight into the wall. Yeah, it's just a very weird and wild.
You got to give us Electrolux's big power move specifically on the second page.
Yes.
But why don't they Triclops call it the Cannonball Special in the very first panel?
Yeah.
I'm like, again, both missed opportunity. Oh my God.
This missed opportunity.
So angry. I'm trying to edit this in my head.
So Triclops uses his beam to set the brooms on fire, which of course we all know that's how Triclops's nasal beams work, is that they set things on fire.
It's a heat ray, everybody.
It's a heat ray. And then Electrolux sucks up all the water from a barrel and puts the fire out.
So there's the snout spout move, and the sound effect as she's drinking the water is gluck, gluck, gluck. She sprays it out and it gets the power move to defeat the brooms. We then move to the Harvey Weinstein section of today's issue. Rex, do you want to tell us about Electrolux in the shower and Trunklops likes to watch?
I mean, he just walks in and it's a little upsetting because there's no real consent here, but she doesn't seem to mind. She wraps her, I thought she wrapped her arm around him, but she just kind of wraps her trunk around his shoulder. It's very, I don't know. And then he tries to pick her up by showing her a picture of his former love, which is actually just a mirror.
He says, I'm very attracted to you, but for all the wrong reasons. You see, I was in love with another, but one night while watching Wild Kingdom, she got a peanut caught in her throat. I tried the Heimlich maneuver, but it was too late. Here's her picture. I thought I'd never find another like her until I saw you. You look just like her. And he hands her a little compact mirror. So when she looks in, she's like, that's me, you bitch, and throws a towel at his face. It's really funny to me. And notice the bathroom mat outside of the shower is a Mr. Peanut reference. Again, there's a lot of delicious little content in the shadows here.
And the towel says Clyde Beatty. Who's that?
Who is that?
I do not know who Clyde. Beat It?
It's an American animal trainer.
Oh. References on references. We move to Mammoth meditating as Electrolux is so upset. The nerve of Trunklops, thinking I would fall for the old "you look just like my dead girlfriend" line. He's such a nerd. And she is interested instead in Mammoth. She gets backlit. It's all sexy. Then she sticks her trunk in his ear in a truly bizarre moment that really grosses me out. As Rumbo opens a panel on the door, like he's the lead in the Emerald City, right? It's the guy that opens the door and starts crying buckets when Dorothy cries about not going home. Rumbo is over all this love bull, he says. So we jump to the next page where Cyclops or Trunclops has realized through their machine, Cerebello, which is a worldwide brainwave scanner, they have a fix on their first adversary. And it seems to be Cerebello is like a boombox that's picking up some odd music. The signal's coming in now. It's a criminal band and we have to follow it to its source. Rumbo says, we gotta follow this junk. Couldn't you at least have found us a band who sounds a little like Stevie Ray Vaughan? And then Electrolux says, odd tune. It sounds like the Horst Wessel song with a big band beat. Horst Wessel was a Nazi who co-wrote the Nazi national anthem. So they're hearing some techno version of the Nazi national anthem over the radio, and we have identified the real threat. Okay, we now go to Magneta's Conservatory of Music, where it in a place where there are where the property values are considerably higher, it tells us. So we're in upstate New York, a little north of the city. Andrew, describe to us our supervillain in this issue, first out of costume.
Yeah, we are introduced 2/3 of the way through this book to the idea that the natural enemy of elephants is musicians, much the same way that clowns and bats hate each other. It's a real head scratcher. And we have a clearly Magneto-inspired villain out of costume, wearing Magneto sort of purples and fuchsias, and with the Quicksilver white hair pulled into points. And I think he's introduced to Mr. and Mrs. Foonman, whose child Leon is going to be at the school.
I do not know what cultural reference Leon Foonman is.
I think the best I could do is that it was an Elephant Man joke. Leon Foonman? Is that what they're going for? I mean, it's terrible if it's true.
No idea.
Yeah, his ears are pointed. His hair is pointed. And pretty soon, the power pachyderms come bursting through the window, accusing him of neo-Nazism. Okay, I recently did a whole bunch of conversations on my show last November around the weird genre of Nazism in pop culture. Here it shows up again. It's the late 1980s. They burst into this guy's house and they find he has a secret room full of like swastikas and a picture of Hitler in the back. And because they found his secret Nazi propaganda room, which is a wild thing to put in a book, Mr. Magneta puts on his music note themed helmet and reveals that he's secretly Clarinetto, the former head of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. And at this point, the parody has lost me, because what the fuck is happening?
If it wasn't Magneto, like the Nazi thing and Magneto, I'm like, that's in poor taste.
Yes.
I'm like, all the characters, Magneto would not be a secret Nazi.
Well, and he's looking very Red Skull here in a very cartoony kind of way. His helmet has music notes instead of like the little Omega, like above the little Omega, like head opening. He says, it's too late to stop me now. Over the past several months, I've duped the youth of these United States into thinking that I'm a swell guy. You'll never convince them otherwise. If you fight me, they'll consider you the villains. Trunclops responds, the youth of America, huh? That's a pretty big audience, and this feels uncomfortable in 2026 to read, where fascism is everywhere. Clarinetto blows a whistle, and it summons, he runs out of the room. What happens here? The sound from his pitch pipe makes all of the elephants plug their ears. I guess their ears are so big, like they have
sensitive. They're so sensitive because they're big?
And then he does a weird set of acrobatics and jumps through an escape chute while calling them elephantine dolts. They follow. We get several blackout panels, again, very Animaniacs of them fighting in the dark. The music has continued, and Clarinetto has now put on his full costume. Andrew, do you want to describe this?
First of all, elephantine dolt, great like Skeletorism. Really? Like, that's very... Y'all never catch me, you elephantine dolts. love that. But yes, of course, Clarinetto's full costume is a mashup of Magneto and the Music Man, essentially.
It's like a drum majorette kind of energy. it's got the little brush shoulder pads and like the buttons that you'd see in like someone leading a band in a street parade kind of. Then we meet the students of this man at the school. Goodness.
The new musicians.
And the joke is that he is like swindling them and teaching them music. This is new MTV generation. We're getting ready to go New Mutants into X-Force, right? Rob Liefeld, right? Like, everything's changing. And we have five musicians here. Rex, who do you see?
I see Prince, or the artist formerly known as. I see Willie Nelson. I see Cyndi Lauper, Madonna, and Bruce Springsteen.
This is a really queer group, oddly. Prince, of course, Madonna, of course, but Cyndi Lauper, this is a gay group of supervillains, and they're in full combat now. Truly wild. Again, the Animaniacs reference is almost the only thing that works. There's a lot of silly moments. Madonna is using like her microphone as like a nunchuck, kind of. Bruce Springsteen's trying to hit people with his guitar. We get some really sick moves from Prince, who just looks like a caricature of Prince. Electrolux gets to kick Willie Nelson in the face, sending his pigtails flying. And then we get the best line. Where did it go here? Cyndi Lauper gets hit and she goes, "Yow, my true color shining through yellow." What?
I mean, it's a song reference, True Colors.
The
but beyond that, effect, I don't know.
And the sound effect of Trunklops spraying his blast everywhere is zooch.
It's eclectic, musicians. I think yellow meaning she's a coward is why she says that's her true color. But it's confusing because we've just seen Trunklops fill the room with yellow energy. So yeah, that maybe was a bit of a wisecrossed moment. I was trying to think if these musicians were deliberately actually X-Men inspired, because Madonna looks so much like Boom Boom, and yeah, Prince kind of looks like Sunspot. You could maybe make an argument for Woody Guthrie being Danny Moonstar. Similar headdress, similar braid. but then it falls apart after
it's,
that.
It's so weird. Okay, so then Clarinetto is playing his clarinet over a vat of radioactive make. I don't know what that even means. And Electrolux gets yanked inside of it. The sound effects are snap, crackle, glop, pocket a fizz. Stuck at the bottom of the barrel, Electrolux struggles to break free, but she is not alone as the irradiated makeup seeps into her pores. Oh, it's makeup. It's radioactive makeup. Oh, gross. As the radioactive makeup seeps into her pores, another being, a new being, also cries out for freedom. Together as one, they cry, and that cry is like a song which will not be denied, a song which will be heard, whether we like it or not. And a giant mutated musical note bursts out in light. And she says, "You can go home now, boys. With me around, you're pretty superfluous." And they go, "Huh?" And he goes, "Oh my God, Ellie?" Which I think is a reference to Negasonic Teenage Warhead.
Wow.
And we now have the big reveal. "Not quite, pachyderms. No longer am I the elephant you knew. I am sunshine. I am shadows. I am darkness. I am light. I am good times. I am bad times. I am daytime. I am night. Yes, now and forever. Wait for it. I am Rogue Elephant." And she doesn't look like Rogue.
No. Nope. More confusion.
Rex, talk to us about this reveal.
I mean, the art's really good. I think that the Rogue Elephant, aka Dark Phoenix or whatever it is, I like the artwork. It definitely, you know, this is probably my favorite artwork on the in the comic. And I do like that when she ignites her powers, it says va 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 voom, which isn't va va voom like something people said back then, like when someone was hot?
Yeah, very Pepe Le Pew, yeah, like chasing the around. Va va voom. Yeah, yeah, very very Groucho Marx in that way. Were you surprised by this reveal, Andrew?
Yeah, because why is she the Phoenix? Why is Elektra? Why is it Elektra and not Jean Grey? Why is she calling herself Rogue Elephant?
I'm just wondering if the writers even read X-Men. I mean, like, really, like... I feel like I could have written something better when I was five.
I adore that she says, "I don't know what you're still doing here, boys. You're now superfluous," which is how we always feel when the Phoenix is around the male X-Men, I think. Now, we get the idea that this new musician, the Phoenix, who now has like billowing red hair and the classic Dave Cockrum costume, except it's on elephant feet. So these, by the way, these characters all have hands, but then really thick-ass elephant feet. So there's that. And she now starts referencing songs in all of her lyrics. We get "I Am Woman" by Helen Reddy. We get "You Don't Own Me" by Leslie Gore. We get "The Warrior" by Scandal. So there's all these references, and then the males are in shredded clothing. The Phoenix, or the Rogue Elephant, then hits a super high note, and it like blows up things things all around the world. We see landmarks in New York and London blowing up, and E.T. Makes a surprise appearance where his spaceship also seems to be blowing up while he's carrying a flower in a pot. You guys, what's happening?
Go ahead, Andrew.
I always love to see my country represented here, an old man in a flat cap with an I Heart UK pin watching Big Ben be destroyed. Thank you for including me in this story, Roger Stone. Really appreciate it.
Do you feel seen?
Yeah. Representation is so important.
So the building is destroyed. The villains are presumably vaporized. I don't even know. And they reference here, she's like unto an angel of death. Terrible yet beautiful. I'm both drawn to her and repulsed at the same time, while she's singing more about you don't own me, I'm not your little girl. And Rumbo says about as much sense as talking elephants. Now she's in danger of being too corrupt. We've got the Dark Phoenix moment. She's singing so much it may destroy everything. Rex, how do they stop him? Or stop her, I mean.
With the feather? what's his name? Mammoth tickles Cyclops' nose and he shoots her and it turns her back.
There's a feather on a dick moment here. I mean, it's the trunk reference, right? Like, I'm going to put a feather on your penis and you're going to explode everywhere. I don't want to go there, guys, but it's a lot.
Is that a reference? Is that a thing? I haven't done that.
We're shooting stuff out of trunks. I don't know what else to do.
Okay.
So she gets knocked aside while singing baby, 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 oh. And now she is back in her right mind and has turned back into the regular form of Electrolux. The radioactive makeup, I guess, has been blown off her completely. They decide to head back to the Three Stooges and take their place. They beat the Three Stooges up in a giant Three Stooges fight and kick them off the mountain. And we get a final reveal on the last page as they all adopt brand new costumes that they are now going to take the place of these ninja masters as the ninjas themselves. I suppose they call themselves the new perfect masters. Andrew, do you want to tell us about their final page costume reveals?
Well, is Mammoth's costume any different? Still just a metal samurai shaped like an elephant. But we do get a more covered up Electrolux, so that's interesting. And then the other two costumes look like sort of Shire Imperial Guard kind of out. Are they trying to look like samurais as well? Very strange.
That fucking ruby hanging out of Trunklops' nose is so bizarre to me.
Is this Sitarak? Is that where that ended up? Like,
So we have a new direction for these characters that we have never ever seen again. What are we feeling about this issue? Let me go Rex and then Andrew.
No. Just no. No. I think my favorite part is that if you look on the back cover, it has Uncanny X-Men 248, which to me is a classic cover where Havoc thinks he's killed Storm. So to me, that was the most exciting part, was the little back cover. I was like, oh, yes, that issue's so good. Other than that, oh.
What the fuck did I read? Kind of feeling at the end of this.
Why? My question is why? I mean.
Do you like the Animaniacs?
Yeah, they were okay.
Yeah, if we read with that kind of zany, campy Warner Brothers kind of energy, I'm wondering if that changes our experience.
But here's the thing, is that there are so many times when Art Adams would write stuff. Or when he would draw stuff, in New Mutants annuals, X-Men annuals, especially with the X-Babies, where they get this goofy, and it's very fun. There's lots of satire stuff, but it's still very engaging. And
I'm legit going there.
I remember loving What the comics around this age, around this time. But I feel like if I had read this when I was 12, I would still have been confused. I would still have been hung up on the same weird choices about the characters that I'm hung up on now. Like, I would be wanting to write Marvel a letter. Why is it Elektra? What are you doing?
Yes. So that's where I want to take this next. And this is where we'll start to wrap up. It's 1988 when this comes out. This is the same year that X-Men Annual number 12 comes out, which is the first appearance of the X-Babies. And if you go back and read that, where Mojo is going crazy and we have to come up with a parody of the X-Men that's going to work. And if you guys remember, there's that single page where it's like they turn all the characters into women and then into animals and then into Transformers and then into babies. And they're like, yes, babies is the one we're going to go with. This is kind of my headcanon, is this is one of those Mojo offshoots. He tried the X-Men as elephants. Major Domo produced the whole show and it just didn't work out. But how have we never seen these characters interact with the X-Men ever again? Because don't you want to kind of see a team up now? Don't you want to see Cyclops meet Trunklops?
No. It's just, here's the thing. Again, so many missed opportunities. Like if Mojo had been in this, if we had realized that's what the wink and the nod was, I think I would have been a little bit on board. But there was, I'm sorry, I can't get on board with this.
I mean, if this were a DC Comics concept, we would have had a whole miniseries about it just like 3 years ago.
So. 100%.
There's a better version of this that could be made, but I don't think there's a reason to make it.
I'm a little bit in love with it. I hate it. I want to be really clear about that, but I love that it's kind of vaguely feminist and vaguely queer. I love that it's of its times. We're celebrating rock and roll. We're doing away with the old and replacing it with something new. It's disjointed, but I don't know. I think it's like obscure arcana in my brain that I get to file away as the only person who has ever spent more than 30 seconds talking about the power pachyderms. It's a weird badge of honor. Thank you both for taking this journey with me today. I promise to have you back on the show for some more quality content in our next review.
Next time, maybe we pick the issue.
Just seeing here, actually, in the credits page, created by Tom DeFalco and Maddie Blaustein. Tom DeFalco didn't write this. Why is he forcing this?
Again, Marvel parody, though, there was a lot happening. This is the same year as the X-Babies. And Tom DeFalco's a lot of over that production at that time. So that doesn't surprise me all that much.
He thought this was such a good idea, he had to make someone else write the comic.
Now, the other two episodes coming out on the show after this month, the issue reviews, I've got some guests joining me to talk about Gail Simone's book, Gus Beezer Meets the X-Men, which is very Calvin and Hobbes. And then we're also going to be reviewing the versions of the X-Men that exist in the Spider-Ham universe. They are called the Uncanny X-Bugs. And you guys, it could have been worse. Power Pachyderms was your better choice.
Okay, I'll take your word.
Stay tuned. We always end the month with a huge academic trial. We're going to be focusing on the characters Rampage and Stiltman at the end of the month. And then over on the Patreon, we're covering some of Marvel's most gimmicky, silly, ridiculous villains. We're going to have a great time. Everybody, hope you're enjoying the show.
Let's see. I'm on www.rexogle.com, but also I'm on Instagram. I also do a newsletter on Substack that started out as like, because my publisher was like, you need to have a newsletter. And I was like, I don't want to sell books on the newsletter. So now I just like do a lot of like ways to find joy and, but also like talk about my favorite books and also like a lot of funny memes on days when horrible people get elected into office. So I try to keep it upbeat. I will say, I mean, I have two books coming out next year. One is called Fruitcake, one is called Absent. But in relation to this podcast, I would just say that in 2 years, I have two books coming out, books one and two, of Bubblegum Coven, which is basically like my little middle school X-Men, but they're witches instead of mutants. And it's awesome. And it's very, very queer coded.
Andrew.
The easiest place to find me online is on Instagram at Wheelagram, where you'll find out about my upcoming comics project, D&D. I do a bunch of D&D writing as well. So I've got a few books coming out for that. You can also check out TO Comics Press, TOCOMIX, on Blue Sky. That is a local Toronto publisher, and I'm editing a new anthology that will be kickstarting in, I think, about a month or two's time from here, which is all about tieflings, devil spawn, like devilkin D&D characters. So it's a queer look at devilish characters, like Nightcrawler is the classic example, in fact, of like a misunderstood devil. And the other thing I will say is, if you go to youtube.com/@KKBBpod, I have a podcast with my friend Shane Holland where we talk about macho pop culture through a queer lens, although we're diversifying into doing a lot of heated rivalry coverage. That'll be old news by the time this podcast comes out. But, you know, it's all anyone can think about at the moment.
We're recording this in early January, everybody, where there's a lot of shockingly great queer content coming out, from Stranger Things to Boots to up overcompensating, heated rivalry. There's some really great queer content coming up.
English teacher,
yes, despite the crazy times, including my forthcoming book. So we're all putting out queer content, which I love. So everybody watch for the release of my graphic memoir, Gay Mormon Dad, coming out this May. Pre-orders are available. And then we're going to keep producing the show. So hope everybody's doing okay. Who knows what's happened in the world between now and March. I keep my own social media private because I got kiddos, but please follow the show at @GrayMalkin_Lane on Instagram most prominently. So thanks everybody for listening. Rex, Andrew, it's wonderful to meet you guys. I can't wait to nerd out again with you both sometime. I hope you had a great time. We'll see you all back here next week.
And now stay tuned for some thoughts on fascism as a special guest and I talk about a Red Skull story and its modern applications.
After Germany's surrender in 1945, Nazism didn't vanish so much as scatter. Former SS officers, party loyalists, and sympathizers immediately began talking about a future comeback they openly called a Fourth Reich. Some of it lived in fantasy, but some of it took organized form. One of the earliest figures around this idea was a man named Otto Skorzeny. That's Skorzeny. Hitler's famous special operations commander, who escaped Allied custody and moved through Spain and Argentina. He associated with ex-Nazis, helped some evade capture, and became a symbol of the belief that the movement could regroup abroad. Around the same time, rumors and partial evidence pointed to loose escape networks, often referred to as Odessa, which helped former SS members flee Europe and maintain contacts within the party. While historians debate how centralized Odessa really was, there's no doubt that many high-ranking Nazis did escape and quietly rebuild lives in South America and the Middle East. By the 1950s and 60s, the Fourth Reich idea shifted from hidden fugitives to open political extremism. In the United States, George Lincoln Rockwell founded the American Nazi Party and openly marched in uniforms modeled after Hitler's stormtroopers. He argued that Nazism had lost the war, but not the future, and that America would eventually become the base of a new racial empire. In Germany itself, far-right groups kept reforming under different names as authorities banned them. Former Luftwaffe ace Hans Ulrich Rudel became a post-war extremist organizer, helping link neo-Nazi movements across Europe and South America. These weren't fringe loners. They were people with war reputations, money, and international connections. The movement grew more violent in the 1970s and 80s. In the U.S., a white supremacist terror group, one of many, this one, though, called The Order, launched assassinations, robberies, and plans to overthrow the government, directly inspired by Nazi ideology. Look it up, worthy of a longer conversation. Its leader, Robert J. Matthews, talked openly about starting a race war that would lead to a new fascist state. Around the same time in Europe, neo-Nazi cells carried out bombings, murders, propaganda campaigns aimed at immigrants, Jews, and political opponents. Authorities increasingly treated these groups not as hate clubs, but as domestic terror threats. In the last decade, the Fourth Reich idea has gone fully digital and more decentralized. In the US, extremist networks like Adam Waffen Division embraced accelerationist violence, encouraging mass shootings, assassinations, and societal collapse to bring about a white supremacist state. Members have been tied to murders and terror plots, and the group has been labeled a serious national security threat. Similar cells appeared across Europe and Canada, often sharing propaganda that directly praised Hitler and talked about completing what the Third Reich started, quote unquote. Instead of one organized movement, it now exists as a loose ecosystem of online radicalization, small terror cells, and ideological copycats, many of them explicitly using the language of a coming Fourth Reich. That is until the election of a certain president. We're now going to jump over to a miniseries called Vengeance. This is a 6-issue miniseries that has a lot of queer content and a lot of X-Men content that people don't expect, including Magneto on a cover, which is great. There's a lot of storylines, there's a lot of things moving around, and it's the first appearance of America Chavez. I'm going to focus this on the Red Skull's version of this story, but with my guest in a minute, we can talk about this whole series. In 1944, Hitler's looking old as he gives Red Skull a speech on the state of affairs. Skull is in his full military regalia, in the highest ranking uniform of the military of the Nazi regime. "These are trying times. We have eliminated the rot that existed within Stauffenberg, and his co-conspirators are no more. Skorzeny awaits his fate. You are aware of the Americans in France and of the resistance uprisings there. We will defend Paris to the last. We will destroy all bridges over the Seine and devastate the city, but it is not those things that preoccupy my thoughts. The Red Army moves on Poland. For the Russians, this is but an opening salvo. They have renewed confidence that suggests a greater agenda. They think we are weak.
But we are far from weak. Schellenberg has confirmed their secret eugenics program to tip the scales of human evolution in their favor. They are close to achieving their goals and must be dealt with. I have decreed that they be eradicated from history. It should be as though they never existed. You are a soldier of the Reich, perhaps the greatest we have ever produced. I know I can count on you. There is no other who could fulfill this assignment. This will be our proudest achievement. And the Red Skull replies, I accept with pleasure, mein Führer. Sieg Heil. We move to the next issue. You have served your purpose, Schweinhund, says the Red Skull. As a Russian scientist of some renown, you have been intimately involved with their top secret eugenics program, true? Don't bother denying it. I have your titles, your papers. I have the list. These names, these families, they will never experience the light you have shown them. In addition, you will be the first to experience the extermination technology I will be using in spinner camps currently built along all along Der Ostfront. In that respect, you are truly a pioneer. Enjoy oblivion! Issue 3, back in 1944, in Poland, the Red Skull is wearing his white fur coat, giving us his best Cruella de Vil. He's commissioned the construction of a new concentration camp to eliminate all of the Russian eugenics subjects and their many children. Issue 4, in 1945, in Poland, the Red Skull walks through the abandoned remains of the concentration camp. His prose in the captions is blood red cursive. This is a moment to reflect on my triumph. There will never be another like this. I have saved the world, and it will never know. My own thoughts echo throughout the emptiness of the pens. Shall I be burdened by the secret of what occurred here? I think not. Are the gods burdened by their choices? They are beyond judgment, as am I. And then comes the news of Hitler's inevitable demise, as the Red Skull realizes that he is now the future of the Third Reich. It's time to launch Operation Der Tag. Issue 5, an old CIA file from 1947 is found, quoting Brigadier General John Magruder and Colonel Alfred McCormick, sent to Director Hillenkoetter, detailing the existence of Nazi spinner camps discovered in isolated regions of northern Poland, doing away with the Russian super soldier experiments from Project Perfect Warrior. Thousands were killed. The Americans chose to never reveal it to the public. Now, there's more going on with the implications of this story, but I'm going to end my summary there and welcome my friend Daniel Guilford to the show. Daniel, how are you? And are you a Red Skull fan, my friend?
I do not like the Red Skull. He is evil, violent, horrific.
I do not like him, Sam. I am.
I do not like him here or there. I do not like him anywhere. It's a joy to be here with you, Chad. Thank you for having me back.
But do you like him with a fox? And do you like him in a box?
Maybe in a box, like a very tiny box with bars.
Let's jump into the world of Vengeance 1 through 6. Some surprising content. What was it like for you to read the first appearance of Miss America?
Yeah, I didn't know this was the first appearance of Miss America. One of my favorite stories ever is Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey's Young Avengers. And I really love that story, and I love the role that Loki and Miss America play in it. And so I'm really excited, actually. I was really excited to see those characters in this story, and I didn't realize that this was Miss America's first appearance, or America Chavez's first appearance. And she really kind of explodes onto the page. And one of the interesting parts about this story is that she gets trapped in another dimension and then can't find her way out, which is kind of a funny thing to happen to Miss America.
Yes, everybody has to learn their powers at a certain point. She's not really the person that we recognize later. It takes them a little time, but she shows up in a variation of Rick Jones's classic 1960s team, the Teen Brigade, alongside a new, very oddly queer character named the Ultimate Nullifier, and then Beacon Angel are here from New X-Men, Grant Morrison's run. We see appearances by Stacey X and Sugar Kane, and there's all these different X-Men members running around, including a Magneto appearance. What were some of your favorite moments or most surprising moments as you looked through this series?
Well, it took me a little while to recognize Beak and Angel, and the reason for that is because they're depowered. I didn't realize this is the period between House of M and Avengers versus X-Men when they get their powers back. So this was kind of confusing for me at first because I was like, wait a second, that's Beak, but he doesn't look anything like Beak really. and then I caught the name Barnell and it started to fall into place because I recognize Angel because it looks very much like Angel. But it's really interesting to see these X-Men characters out of their sort of X roles. And actually the only time that a character kind of barges in and says, we need to deal with mutant problems, is Magneto in the very first issue, and he's kind of promptly dismissed. So it's interesting as an X-Men fan to kind of watch this play out over the pages. This isn't really an X-Men story, but it definitely has some elements of the things that matter to someone like me who is an X-Men fan, looking for stories about meaning, about purpose, about justice, about community. These things are all important themes in Vengeance.
So this is a Joe Casey, Nick Dragotta six-issue series from 2012. It's kind of a weird one. It's got an odd name, but I really enjoy these books that use the Marvel play, like the whole sandbox. We're going to pull some characters from here and here and kind of mix them all together. And then you get random like appearances of supervillains you wouldn't expect to see, like Taboro from the Purple Dimension. You know, those are always really fun moments for me. And you never know quite where a character is going to take off. Anytime you read a character's first appearance, it's not always the character we know and love. Shuri is an excellent example of that in the comics as well. Did you have any story points in Vengeance that left you curious or that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, this plot is completely wacky. It's basically the clash of three different superhero or supervillain groups that are kind of coming together. The supervillains are trying to kill the supervillains and the superheroes are trying to stop it. It's all very confusing. It took me until the last page when you're reading literally the sixth chapter and they say, oh, we have added all these beautiful covers and we decided to make a story that fit the covers, not the other way around, for me to realize, oh, that's why all these interesting framing devices, and that's why we're kind of all over the place. But it is really a beautiful story. It has a lot of, you know, this Red Skull story is not actually relevant to the plot at all, except for as a way to motivate and sort of show the contrast between how the two young teams are handling this generational conflict. One of the things that really stood out to me when I read this story was this generational conflict of the old guard kind of having their own problems, their own agenda, and then the new kids on the block, the good superheroes and the bad supervillains, arriving on the scene and trying to figure out, how do they deal with this? How do they deal with the mess that the old guard has left them? And
we'll go back to Avengers 6 when Baron Zemo, the war criminal from the Nazis, starts a brand new supervillain group called the Masters of Evil, right? And the word masters, when you realize it's started by a Nazi, it's a little different, even though there's a lot of versions of that team. And here we have this villain group that's parallel to the teen brigade, calling themselves the Young Masters, which is giving very Hitler's youth, and it's a problem. So the relevance of like how we measure evil and the Red Skull's place in that is always an interesting parallel, because he's the very far right of what evil looks like. And yes, I chose the words far right on purpose.
Yeah, and the other thing that's like pretty obvious when you look at these two different teams is the superhero team, the teen brigade. There we go. All right, so the teen brigade, they're all unmasked, and the Young Masters all have masks. That was one thing that really stood out to me as I was reading the story. And the only character that the Young Masters take off their masks a few times, and it's when they're either being defeated or beheaded.
It's incredible writing for what it is. Fun playing in the sandbox and fun new characters along the way. Now, I opened with thoughts on the formation of kind of Nazi ideals post-war, with the idea of kind of the Fourth Reich and how that's clearly seeded into not only American politics, but also world politics. But there was a check and a measure balance. And, you know, when I end my summary on those like stirring words of like, until the most recent election, those boundaries feel very stripped away. Did you have any thoughts on kind of those opening thoughts? And then how are you doing in 2026, my friend?
It's a challenging time. I'm a climate scientist, so it's a challenging time to be a climate scientist when truth is sort of being pushed back, when facts and details and information is being assaulted at every corner. I am struggling at times. I'm finding hope at times. One thing that's really been important to me in this time is to find community. One of the things I love about this teen brigade team is they seem to be, even though they kind of go at each other's throats here and there, they seem to be a tight-knit community, and they have shared sort of values and
found family for sure.
And you know, that's something obviously I love from the X-Men, and to see it here was a beautiful thing. The other thing that really stuck out to me about this story is one of the catalysts for the way the Teen Brigade sort of decides to take on the young masters towards the end of the plot line is when the ultimate nullifier receives the CIA document. He reads it over. He discovers the main truth, which is in that, which is that the United States covered up this particularly heinous crime. And the reason they did that is because they wanted to further their agenda in their war, their Cold War against Russia. Now, that's all window dressing to say that sometimes the government will let, whether it be the far right, will let the extremist group fester for their own benefit and for their own agenda. And that can be extremely, I think that's something that's extremely relevant for today. And that's extremely kind of, it's a wake-up call. You know, it's like, oh, look who the villains are. Look what's happening. And how are we going to respond to that? And in that scene, there are two responses to it. The Black Knight chooses to walk away, and the Ultimate Nullifier chooses to engage and to be a force for change and good in the world. And I think we are faced in this same moment in 2026 with this shock to our system. How will we respond to the ongoing violence, the ongoing troubles we see in our country here in the United States, and indeed the rise of fascism, authoritarianism across this planet? How will we respond? Will we walk away? Will we hide? Or will we engage and be a force for good in the world? And I think this was really challenging to me as I was reading it, to feel not only a thread of hope from my found family, but sort of a conviction to know I need to engage.
You're such an eloquent speaker, Daniel. You put so much heart into your words. You're good at what you do. And I know you and I, we have different stories, but we both wear a lot of hats, right? From parent to partner, to queer individual, to nerd, to, you know, professional who's engaging with the public while operating in queer spaces. Easy to get overwhelmed. Hard not to get overwhelmed sometimes. Climate change is a really good parallel for this, though. There's this kind of doom and gloom feeling about it, but we can either fight it or let it happen. And what's it going to be? And there's an odd parallel, though, for fascism, I think, as well. I enjoyed your company for a long time. I will forever associate Peter Corbeau with you, of course. And I hope we get a chance to hang out again soon, my friend. It's great to see your face.
It's wonderful to spend time with you, Chad. Thanks for having me.
We're recording this, everyone, on February 2nd. It will release in late March. Who knows what has happened in the world between now and then. Right now, it feels like a very, very brief reprieve after the Alex Preddy news, and we're Epstein files, and we're just waiting for what the fuck's going to happen next. Just, it's a lot. So please take care of yourselves. Reminder that living joyfully is an act of defiance. Reach out to your community. Stay safe out there. Great to see you, Daniel. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you back here next week on Grey Malkin Lane. Thank you for listening to Grey Malkin Lane. We hope you are enjoying this podcast. Grey Malkin Lane is produced and recorded in Salt Lake City, Utah, with music and editing done by my husband, Michael Bell, and promo art done by the incredible Seth Martell. Look for us on Patreon, where we are releasing weekly episodes about obscure characters and facts. It's a great way to participate with the podcast for only just a couple of dollars a month, and it helps support what we are doing here. Also, the best way you could help Grey Malkin Lane is by sharing and liking and subscribing, but also please leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. We'll see you back here next time on Grey Malkin Lane.